Committee call to order. Today's Friday, March 2, 2012, and the time is 8:30. President of Representative Puggy, Representative Seaton, Representative Peggy Wilson, Vice Chairman, Representative Pruitt, myself, Representative Alan Dick. Reminder about cell phones. We're going to start this morning with a distance education presentation by Dr. Alex Hu of the University of Alaska, followed by HB 256, Restoration Intervention, and finally HB 313, Student Count Estimates. We have a lot to get through today, so I ask presenters and members to be mindful of this as we move through the meeting. We got a late start due to budget closeout, so I apologize for that, but now we can move on without any interruptions. We are privileged to have a presentation by Dr. Alex Hu of the University of Alaska. I actually got a hold of the university, and I wanted, before I put my credibility, before I spoke on his behalf, I needed to get a letter of confidence from, we do have that with us here. We have a letter of confidence and recommendation from the Chancellor, Brian Rogers. So we, I always knew. I just wanted to get proof from your boss. So, Dr. Hu, if you'd come and go through your presentation for us. First, identify yourself for the record. And Ann, would you like to join him?
No, I'm good.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, Dr. Hu, if you'd identify yourself for the record and go with your presentation, sir.
Okay. My name is Alex Hu. I'm from University of Alaska Fairbanks. And I appreciate the opportunity to speak with a chairman and an older representative. So I can start?
Please.
Okay. So today I want to give you guys a brief overview what is e-learning at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. So first of all, Center for Decent Education is, you know, it's a 27-staff operation, right now actually 29. We are handle overall delivery of the e-learning, which is online courses for the University of Alaska. And out of 29 staff, we have 10 instruction designers. Their job is developing courses, working with faculty, training faculty, getting the course transitioned from face-to-face to online. And we also have about 10 student service personnel, which is front desk, technical services, advisor, and also secure testing center. And we have enrollment of approximately right now, it's a little bit higher this year, about 7,500 annually, and it's about 26,000 student credit hour. And as the national trend, the enrollment has been growing the last 4 years, about, you know, 10 to 15% in online. So clear show right now students really enjoy the flexibility of online learning. They want more opportunity to explore their education option. We serve about 4,300 individual students across the state, and the majority of them still is from Fairbanks main campus. So can you imagine the student in the dorm? They're actually attending the school, but they're taking a lot of online courses because fit their schedule. And our age distribution for the students between is about half of them is the high school graduate attending university, and we also have about almost 30%, 30 years and older. We see a lot of, especially after 2008, the economic downturn, we see a lot of people come back to the university to retool their skill. So give you a brief overview how it looks like, the demographic distribution. So really within Alaska, this is back in 2009, 2010, so we have a 91%, but right now I would say the out-of-state, which is out of Alaska, grew to about 12%, but majority is still within Alaska. And so within Alaska, then half of them is from Fairbanks, North Pole area, including the military base. Half is outside. And it's not surprising, but it is higher than the national with the female and male ratio. About 70% of our students are female, 30%. Male, and the national average is more like 55-45, female and male. And the student age distribution, again, primarily is the 19 to 25 college student. But we start seeing the growth in the adult learner, because adult learner really do take advantage of the flexibility of online learning, so they don't have to commit losing their working hours, so they can study in the night, weekend. So this is, I just want to give you an idea, this is us today, how the our distribution looks like in terms of student. So you can see before was about 50% Fairbanks, North Pole. As today, Fairbanks, North Pole still growing, the number, but it's just outside of Alaska growing so much faster. So that's really our goal, to really be able to serve the student around the state. Yes.
You said
outside Fairbanks.
Okay.
My bad, sorry. Sure. And we have about, yes.
Alex, we have a question. Representative Seaton.
So UAF, is that the Center for Distance Education for all three of the branches, or does UAF all?
Or UAF only.
Just UAF. Yes. So UAA will have its separate Center for Distance Education for it and its rural campuses?
Within the University of Alaska system, we're the only unit that is comprehensive offer e-learning. So at UAA and UAS is sort of at their own department of school, so they don't have a centralized unit to handle all the logistics.
So,
follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to figure out then, so if someone in Homer, mm-hmm. through the Ketchikan Bay campus, is taking distance ed, and that's a UAA rural campus, mm-hmm. is that through this program, or is that through University of Alaska Anchorage program?
Most likely University of Alaska Anchorage program.
Okay.
Thank you. Go ahead.
So, sorry, the map sort of cut off at the end, but you can see a student spread around all over Alaska. So we do a zip code and the Google Maps just to find out where our student is. So we were worried about bandwidth, but because you have to have internet to be able to take our courses, and we were really kind of surprised it's become more spread around than before. That just say around Alaska, every student have the chance to finish education. Doesn't matter where they are, where it be. So give you an idea that really this is the growth. The first one on upper left is the student credit hour. We increased about 45% from 2007 to 2012. Compare to the face-to-face overall UA growth about average 3 to 5%. So you can see the demand on the online learning. Then on the lower bottom left is give you the reason I want to show this, because at CDE is a 98% self-sustained unit. We depend on tuition and fee. It's only 2% from state budget. So it's entrepreneurial, so we have to be able to react fast and quick, because at this day and age is student looking for what's best for them. Either we help them to deliver that or give them a choice to choose within the state of Alaska, they go somewhere else. Because online there's no limit, no boundary. So it's not we do it or we have to do it the best we can. So, and the other two on the right, I want to give you an idea. We are working on program development. So before we were offering just by individual courses, now we are pushing the whole degree program online. So you can see when we started degree program online for applied business associate degree, spring 2010, that's the intercept point, then you can start see the enrollment jump. Once you get a degree program online, they give a sense for students, say, hey, I can finish this. And they continue, because they get a cohort, they continue to take the rest of courses. The Sanders Allen Health endorsement, we have filed them. We started 2009 to developing courses. We see the zero enrollment all the way. Right now, I think that's per semester. This year, we're probably looking at 600 enrollment compared to 2 years ago, 195 enrollment. It just gives a student a chance to finish all the required endorsement course online. So that's out of state, where our student come from. It's no surprise, it's northwest of the region has most of our out of state student. So again, I just want to run this through very quickly. So we have about 184 individual courses. Right now we have 3 complete degree online. One is Master of Innovation in Education, Innovation of Technology in Education. And we work with all the school department at the UAF. The only couple department we're still exploring the possibilities, mechanical engineering and also the fishery. We have some course from fishery, but a lot of their course is hands-on. So anything require hands-on, it takes a lot of simulation. And because we want to develop a course, in CD to meet the minimum requirement of whatever intended outcome for the face-to-face. So our course can be the high rigor and high quality. So that's why when we ever deliver any course, we require a lot of the experimental in the laboratory, we have to find a different path to approach that. And the way we manage our courses, we work with academic departments, so they have academic oversight. So we work very close with the professor, with the dean, so make sure everything we deliver is in their program assessment, because we still want to make sure their accreditation standard is being met. And the way we design online course, just give you a quick overview. So most of us here go to a class, we sit in the class, and then the professor start give you a lecture. Then in online, the professor has to think differently. They have to think, okay, what it is this course supposed to be from the beginning? At the end of the course, my students should know A, B, and C. So we base on those outcomes, the objective, then we find activity and the course content to meet the objective. So the course no longer just chapter 1 to 12. The course may be spread around first chapter 2 and 15, depends how the best way to approach. So online course really is different than face-to-face. I keep telling everybody, online course, we provide the same outcome and rigors as a face-to-face, but it's a different learning experience. You don't anticipate you sit in the class, seeing your student and seeing the interaction, the facial with your faculty. We build a course so students can really engage their own learning style. You know, everybody here, we have virtual learner. We maybe somebody like to read. Some people like to read, you know, study in the middle of night. Somebody study one in the early morning. In the regular course, you cannot do that. But online course, you can choose your own learning path, but still have the interaction with all your classmates and your faculty. Then they go through the whole process. That's why in the national, the last 15 years of research have proven students learn at least the same or better in online course, and the success rate is probably 3% higher. To say that means you have to have very good quality course and program. You know, when we talk about that, the research wasn't research any for profit. The research didn't touch the University of Phoenix online course and the rest of for-profit industry, which is last year about 1 million enrollment per semester. That's a combination of California, Texas, Florida together to get that many enrollment. So that's our course framework design and the personal learning environment. And we really focus two things at CDE. First, the quality of the course and student success. In order to do that, every single course we develop is within, you know, we work with, of course, Alaska faculty and the state here. And the critical thinking piece, that's why we're thinking. In our course, we don't really worry about students read the textbook and do the quiz. It's really, okay, how do you do problem solving match to your real life? How can we create an environment students can fail carefully? Because we all learn better when we make mistakes. So that's what we try to do in every single courses. We don't develop courses cookie cutter like template format. No, we treat each individual courses carefully. What is the best approach? And I always work with my staff and work with faculty. Dream big. Dream the best course you can. Forget everything you ever learned. What the ultimate biology 103 can look like. Then we come close as possible. Because if we only look at status quo, we only have the course 50 years ago. You know, technology is so advanced right now, we have to be able to take advantage to help the faculty and the student learn better, engage together. So there's a lot more slide, but I think I pretty much covered most of it. So the slide, this additional information is for you to later can take a look. Another thing I want to address is right now at CD we are looking how can we serve the student across Alaska better, because we have found out the last 3 years we have tremendous growth on Devon Math and English enrollment. That indicates the kids who receive from high school is not ready for university course. So they spend the first 2 years relearn what they're supposed to learn junior and senior. So I try to figure out what's going on, because we simply cannot continue this trend, because then the student will take 6-7 years or even longer to graduate from university, which will delay their potential being a full-time worker. So what we try to do is working with Department of Education to find out how can we bridge the gap. So the student, we will help the student prepare earlier in junior, senior level, so those courses can be provided. And doesn't matter where a student coming from, rural district, they get those quality courses, then they take them first, then when they come to university, they finish within 4 to 5 years. So part of the challenge right now is how do we do that? Because the infrastructure wasn't there before. Juneau, Fairbanks, Anchorage, they all have the online course available. They buy from, you know, BYU or Utah or somewhere else. But rural school district, when I visit them, they really don't have the teacher to be able to offer 4 years science and math and English. So that becomes problematic. So that's part of the effort we work really hard with right now, Department of Ed, the Alaska Learning Network, try to get that result. And hopefully, with the collaboration, we can reach that goal. Thank you.
Question from committee. Representative Wilson.
Thank you. Mr. Hu, what, because you've gone out to these different areas, so when you are trying to work on not having that gap, is it because they just haven't had the opportunity to get the extra courses, or are the schools not teaching to a high enough level? Why do we have so many kids that are not ready when they get to college? Do you have any enlightenment on that at all?
Chairman and Representative Wilson, so when my doctoral research dissertation actually bring me to the rural region, Alunato, Kotzebue, so what I find out, first of all, turnover of the high school teacher or K-12 teacher is a big problem. Second, in rural school district, it was shocking for me when I work in the district, they have one teacher to cover 9 to 12 grade or 8 to. So I think it's because they don't have enough resource to deliver those courses needed, because a new teacher comes in with education degree has the capacity to cover math in depth or English in depth sometimes. So it's nobody's fault, it's just the nature of the, you know, Alaska so spread out, and we have 140 school district has less than 20 students in high school. As that, you know, no other state, I think, in the United States ever faced that big challenge. So part of the solution is really how we build the, because the several things we cannot control. We cannot control the fact, you know, teacher come and go. The only thing we can do is build the high quality course content, because that part we can control. And doesn't matter who the fact that the teacher comes in, there's a fundamental there, so we can make sure that the outcome is reached.
A follow up on that?
A follow up?
So you're saying that no one would be able to do to provide all of that. I mean, you know, one teacher in with 20 kids, it's just not fair to that teacher, probably. Mm-hmm. Should we be providing an extra teacher in the classroom now that might only have 20 kids, but they're all in a different grade or something? Or, you know, if it's in high school, there's 4 grades, and there's no way that she can teach that. Now, so distance classes is one of the answers that would help. Do we as legislators need to think about putting an extra teacher in those areas? What is your thoughts on that?
I'm not quite sure how would the, I think more, you know, qualified teacher definitely help. And that plus to help the teacher get them the proper training so they feel much easier to deliver content they are not familiar with, I think that's another approach. So I think both work together, then definitely will provide a much better solution. So we don't rely on, you know, one way to resolve the big problem. So when I visit rural side, always amazed how the faculty have to work the diverse group of students. Yeah, like you say, it's really tough for them to handle the fourth grade difference or three grade difference in the seven different subject discipline area.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I also want to recognize Representative Tammy Wilson being with us here today. And Representative Seaton, we do need to move on. Alex, we really need to, each one of us need to connect with you before you go. But Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was intrigued by your talking about different learning styles. So within your courses, are the materials such that, depending upon what the learning style of that student is, they have multiple ways of receiving that content? Or how did you mean that distance education works on the different learning styles? Or do you develop a course that is basically directed towards one learning style and that's the way the course is, or are there multiple facets in the single course?
Chairman, Representative Sitton. So all the online courses is managed by a so-called learning management system. So we use Blackboard at UAF. So when we develop online courses, it means everything's complete. So we develop like YouTube learning activity, we divide different project-based learning simulation. So a student can go over and over again the same material, and they never have to worry about taking the notes. At the same time, they can say, okay, I learn better by watching this video than read first. Some students may say, oh, I like to see what's my project I'm going to do. Then I find out what's the best way to help myself to understand that subject area. So we present all the possible, the best we can think of. I mean, while working with the faculty, those content is all there. So student can, the best thing for the student, they never will miss anything. You know, when we go to a class, if I like drink for 5 minutes, I forget what the teacher is thinking and saying, I forgot to write down. No, it never will happen in online because everything was properly built before we even offer the course. So that when I mentioned the different learning styles, give the student opportunity to pick and choose within that particular week assignment to get things finished.
Representative Seaton.
And one reference you made in there was that you coordinated with the learning network with the high schools or presentation. How can you provide these things for high school students totally separate from that? Or is that coordinated through the way you work?
I think at CDE, we are capable to provide our expertise in terms of course development, and also because we have quite a few developmental math and English, so those are actually sophomore, junior, senior math course, so we can really work with the Department of Education to transition those courses for them to offer across the state for high school students, or we can also make that option as dual credit, so students actually earn college credit, the junior, senior, while I finish their requirement course for qualified Alaska Performance Scholarship, then the same time go to university. Then at CDE, we also can help to scope this infrastructure for supporting the teacher and mentoring the high school student. So I think we can do those.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Hu. Yeah, the one thing that attracted me here was that if we had Dr. Hu and his team developing our high school courses, then it would be seamless for them to go straight from high school right into the college program. And the other thing that really kind of intrigued me was that with your abilities that you could actually train Alaskan teachers to be developing the online courses, and that aspect also intrigued me. We do need to move on, but Dr. Hu, I appreciate your patience this morning, appreciate you being here, and I would encourage all the committee members and Chair Wilson to spend time with Dr. Hu because his presentation, his resume, and everything he has to offer us, I really believe he's a treasure in this state. So, Dr. Hu, thank you. Okay, we will take up HB 256, State Intervention in Schools. Representative Pruitt, will you move committee substitute version X for adoption?
Mr. Chair, I move committee substitute for HB 256 version X dated 2/27 for adoption as our working document.
And I'll object for discussion, okay. Explanation of change.
We better get done pretty soon. We're on X. All we got left is Y and Z, you know. okay. okay. Thank you, Representative Pruitt. We do have committee substitute for HB 256, version X, before us. Annette, will you walk us through the changes in the committee substitute? Then there are three amendments on your desk for consideration. And identify yourself for the record.
Chairman, I'm trying to figure out which of these mics I'm going to be closer to. Annette Kreiser, staff, Representative Alan Dick.
Oh, excuse me, time out. We don't have the amendments, Annette?
Do we have the amendments?
On your desk.
These.
On your desk.
I have them here.
They should be on your desk. Do you want to know how to use, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah. Order. And that if you'd walk us through the changes in the CS, and then we'll speak to the amendments.
Again, Mr. Chairman, Annette Kreitzer, staff to Representative Alan Dick. First change occurs on page 6, lines 12 to 15. We have two copies of CS, and one of them has them highlighted. And this adds the language, notwithstanding that a school or district has demonstrated two consecutive years of improvement, the district may, in its discretion, and there's a typo here, it should re-choose to receive restoration services for a third year. This amendment just allows the school or district, after two consecutive years of improvement, to maintain or be able to continue restoration services. And then beginning page 6, line 30, the previous version of the bill did not incorporate what the sponsor had intended, which is setting out a process for year one. So beginning there and all the way through page 8, line 9, this rewrites the year one activities so that in year one you have a selection of at least one independent expert by August the 15th, and the district superintendent and the commissioner select that expert or those experts. And then also in year one, the experts will have evaluated the school in the areas that are requested. And the district will also be evaluated on implementation of state cultural standards. Year one, experts produce a written report by October the 15th and distribute that. And a summary is posted on the internet. By November 15th, the superintendent and the department select a qualified coach, and the local school board and the department select a qualified coach. These coaches will advise the district regarding the needs identified in the evaluation. On June 1st, the department provide to the department, the parents, the legislature, and post on the internet a summary of progress of those efforts and the observations and recommendations of the coaches. Then for year two, not later than September 15th, have a mandatory selection and hiring of two additional qualified coaches to advise the district, and then one of those is selected by the superintendent and one is selected by the local school board. Also in year two, by June 1st, provide to the department, parents, legislature, and post on the internet a summary of the progress of those efforts. Page 8, lines 10 and 11. This is the language that introduces the third year, and it's just slightly reworded, not a major change there, just a slight revision. And then page 8, lines 18 to 21. This adds, in the school improvement team that's created in year 3, it adds a member of the State Board of Education. And then for the four qualified coaches selected under A and B. And there was some concern about having a legislative member of that team, and so that language was deleted from the school improvement team. Also on page 8, lines 27 to 31, and page 9, lines 1 to 2. I think there was concern that, you know, gee, what is the team doing, and, you know, how do we ensure that something comes out of that effort? So this adds a requirement that the school improvement team develop a three-year plan to restore the school, and the team may redirect district funding to improve instruction, and the superintendent must implement the team's plan At the end of each school year, the team will evaluate and adjust the plan. And this gets to the concern of the committee that we want to make sure that all of this effort results in something and that there are continual checks and balances all along the way. And finally, on page 9, lines 3 and 4, it adds a new section requiring the department to request proposals from and provide grants subject to appropriation to schools or districts that are in restoration. And those are the changes to the CS from version E to version X, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, any comments from committee?
So, Mr. Chairman, I guess maybe it's covered in page 9. I haven't been able to review that yet. The coaches in years 1, 2, and 3, or those members, those are provided out of district funds. Are those only provided if the legislature appropriates money? How are those expenses paid?
Well, at the time, Representative Seaton, at the time of envisioning this, Network, do you want to respond to that?
Through the Chair, Representative Seaton, I think the intention is that the department would pay for those coaches, mm-hmm. but it's not explicit in the bill.
Okay. Representative Seaton.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, I just think that we ought, you know, I mean, oftentimes what happens if we put in a requirement and we don't say how it's going to be funded,
sure.
we'll have a problem. So at some point, I think that we ought mm-hmm. to clarify who's expected out of what budgets to pay for those.
Thank you. Any other comments from committee before we get to the amendments? Okay.
Mr. Chair,
I think I
objected to the adoption, and so I'll remove my objection.
Oh, thank you. Hearing no further objection, the CS version X is adopted. And okay, Representative Pruitt, will you move amendment number one, sir?
I move amendment number one.
And
I'll object for discussion.
Okay. Annette, would you want to talk us through this, please?
Annette Price, your staff to Representative Dick. On page 7, line 4, this goes to the areas that the independent expert would review, and this was a language change by the drafter to student preparedness when the sponsor actually meant preparedness of students to learn. And there is a difference in those terms. And so the same change, also page 8, line 26, somehow the term student wellness was introduced, and it really is, again, this is where the team is evaluating best practices for those things that are similar to what you see on page 7. Preparedness of students to learn is what was intended there.
And if I could speak to that, the intention here that what the expert would be looking at is, it's not whether a child is ready, has the right math skills to enter the fourth grade. The question is, are parents sending students to school that are sleepy, they're not ready to learn? That was the intent here, that responsibility of the parent could be addressed by somebody from outside that community. That was the intent. Representative Wilson.
Nothing.
Mr. Chairman, just clarifying. So amendment number one, I'm sorry, mine were out of order here. So that was page 7, line 4, and page 8, line 26. Is that correct?
Through the Chair, Representative Seaton, that's correct.
Thank you. I'll remove my objection.
Okay. And with no further discussion, amendment number one passes. Representative Pruitt, would you move amendment number two, sir?
Mr. Chair, I move amendment number two.
And which amendment is that?
Amendment number two is page 7, lines 9 through 11.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd object for discussion.
Annette, if you would.
Mr. Chairman, page 7911 corrects an error in the CS. The drafter inadvertently inserted in the evaluation, and in fact, Representative Seaton, this was your amendment to the CS initially, that experts shall evaluate the extent to which the district has implemented. It should be the Alaska State Cultural Standards instead of the Standards for Culturally Responsive Schools.
So
I'll remove my objection.
Okay. With no further objection, amendment number two passes. And Representative Pruitt, would you move amendment number three, which refers to page 8, line 5?
I move amendment number three.
And I'll object for discussion, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Annette, would you walk us through that, please?
Sure. On page 8, line 5, this is the second year report that's provided to the department, parents, and legislature, a summary of the progress of the efforts. And the sponsor thought that at this point in time, the State Board of Education should also receive a copy of that report so that it's clear to them what's going on, so that they're included in that discussion.
And Mr. Chairman, I'll remove my objection.
Okay. And with no further objections, amendment number three passes. Oh, Representative Wilson.
I would like to go to page 7 of the bill, mm-hmm. and at the top, under parens I, in there on line 4, it talks about, I guess the whole section right there. Selection by the superintendent of the district and the commissioner of at least one independent expert in the area of business services. Now, does that mean that the commissioner is going to provide an expert of business services, an expert on board governments, or is that, or is he going to pick out of this group one independent expert? I'm not sure what that means. So if you could explain that that whole little section right there.
Representative Wilson, the intent was that the expert would come in and evaluate in regards to all of those areas. And those are the areas that we thought that a school – see, a lot of times somebody will come in and start talking about curriculum and teachers, but there were all of these other concerns that a district might be deficient in. And so we spoke to, well, you know, how well is the business office working? How well is the board doing, et cetera? But I understand your question. Do we have an expert that's an expert in only one of those, or would you have one expert who's evaluating all of the above? And I understand your question. I think somebody would help us to wordsmith the amendment.
We need to clarify that person that, and I'm an independent expert so that person needs to think about the business services of the school, the school board, leadership, I assume, means administrators,
mm-hmm.
Human relations, what do you mean by that? That's a big open box right there. And so what do you mean by human relations? The relationships of the kids to the teachers, the relationships of the board to the school, the relationship of the administration. What are you trying to get at right there?
Well, I think my intent was all of the above, but I'd certainly entertain any clarifying thought. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Possibly, Mr. Chairman, it could be clarified by on line 2, inserting after expert to evaluate, and then eliminating the word in, and adding an S behind area on line 3. So it would read the commissioner, you know, the district and commissioner of at least one independent expert to evaluate the areas of business services, board governance, leadership. I think that, but since it was Representative Wilson's idea, I mean, if
I think that
if
would,
that works.
Yeah, I would, let me, this is, the commissioner of at least one independent expert to evaluate the areas of business services, board governments, leadership facilities, human relations. So I would say that's what I would. So I would move conceptual amendment number 4 to read. Actually, you're going to cross out on line two. You're going to cross out in and mm-hmm. add to evaluate.
Mm-hmm.
And then on line 3, you're going to add an S to area. So it will say to evaluate the areas of, and then I don't know what's the correct way to, the areas of business services, board governments, leadership facilities, blah, blah, blah. So does that make it clear to everyone?
And Representative Wilson, I would even be willing to have before the word leadership, administrative leadership, because I think that was the original intent.
Okay. Are you going to, do you have an amendment to the amendment?
I was hoping you'd slide it in.
Okay, well, okay, let's say I'll add one more then. So the conceptual amendment is on line 2, cross out in and add to evaluate. And then on line 3, you add an S after the word areas. And then whatever punctuation is needed there after of. And then after governance, comma, add administrative leadership. Mm-hmm. Add administrative in front of leadership.
Okay. And
then that is it.
Okay. So let's see, where are we? Did you move that amendment?
Yes.
Yes, you did.
Any objection?
No.
With no objection, amendment number 4 passes.
Okay. Now, I really truly think I really think you need to define human relations. That's so wide. What are we looking at here? Human relations in the community as a whole. I don't know for sure what you really mean there, and I think we need to define that just a little, or at least narrow it down just a little. That's just open for discussion for anybody here.
I think it's probably it's going to what's commonly human relations is commonly associated with, and that means the relations within the school there, the people, the teachers, the administrators, the janitors, all that kind of stuff. Human relations is typically the relations under the umbrella of whatever entity we're talking about. So careful what kind of relations they're having, I guess. But.
Mr. Chairman, I
Representative Bagney.
Representative Wilson, I think we can probably leave it the way it is. I mean, okay. This is the selection by the superintendent of the district and the commissioner. You know, let's leave them some latitude.
Okay.
They're smart guys, girls. They can make that decision.
Alrighty.
And that's, we shouldn't dwell on micromanaging.
Okay.
Folks.
Okay.
Fair enough. All right.
Yeah, I'm fine if everybody else is fine.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Is there any further committee discussion on CSHB 256? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a large change from the bill.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not just this, but E as well, and I don't think we've had a presentation by either the people that are supposed to implement this. So I'm wondering if we can get the department and the administrators to, or maybe we haven't closed public hearing and they can mm-hmm. do it then. But I'd sure like to hear from them as to whether they can integrate this and whether there's any time issues with the way we've structured the bill.
Very good. Okay. Any other comment from committee? Okay, Representative Wilson.
I just do want to comment that I think that the change probably may make things flow better, possibly when a school finds themselves in this situation, in the fact that we know they know exactly what's going to happen each year and how it's going to happen. And I really kind of think that that probably is good, and also gives the department an idea of what they should do. And so I think probably this is probably pretty good. And it just by the way it's worded, that the collaboration that our goal was, helps that collaboration to happen automatically. So I think it's probably pretty good.
Thank you. Representative Seaton.
Mr. Chairman, and possibly I'm just not finding it here yet, but I'm wondering when year one is and what the conditions are. I mean, I think that we've got, you know, some really good ideas in this bill of making sure that we're being proactive, but I'm unsure of what point that takes place or what conditions.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Seaton. I was, for me, it was a blurry point as well. I'm trying to find it here in the bill because, and Annette, if you'd help me.
Through the chair, Representative Dick, bottom of page 6, for the first school year after the designation of the school as a low performing school. Is that what you were looking for?
It is, and I guess maybe this is for other testimony. I'm not sure at what point is this AYP, if you've missed three, or if it's the first year you miss AYP, or what is the how do we get to that designation of low performing in it? I mean, there's a reference here, but I'm just not sure what it is, and I want to make sure we've got it appropriately targeted in the bill.
Representative Seaton, I understand your question. I had the same thought, but I was hoping I wouldn't. I was willing to go with the department's determination of that at this point, and that I thought maybe down the road we could actually. I was willing to live with the department's definition of that, and.
I would just like the department to explain to us what that definition is. I mean, if it's 3 years of underperformance below standards, if it's 1 year below, if it's the first year. Then all of a sudden we would have a huge fiscal note and a huge thing. If it's the first year you blow average, you're low performing, and now all of a sudden we're trying to enter
26 school districts.
To have restoration activities. And so I'm just wanting to get it clarified for myself and on the record. Thanks.
Thank you, sir. Okay. Thank you, Annette. Commissioner Hanley, you want to help us out? Thank you, Commissioner. Identify yourself for the record.
For the record, I'm Mike Hanley.
Feel free, any comments or thoughts? We're trying to come up with a good product here.
I'm the Commissioner for the Department of Education and Early Development. Do you want me to share a few thoughts to begin with questions? The primary focus I've had in everything I've done is to focus on kids and making sure that the things we do focus on kids. I think there's a lot here that that directs the department and directs districts when things are not going well and kids are not performing well and they're not getting the skills they need. So I think there's a lot of positive aspects to the things that are here. There are a couple of things that I would probably like to just point out and allow for your own interpretation, but things that caught my eye that may not have been considered in regards to the bill. On page 2, I did notice, and I believe Representative Seaton brought it up previously, in regards to on line 14, the number and percentage of turnover, and the language that was included was, and the reasons for. And I think that's a great idea. It's a great thought. And having exit interviews and things like that is a great thing to do. It was suggested that we do that, and we've done that for a few years, and we did a Survey Monkey, and we made it voluntary and received zero. Responses, and as a matter of fact, one of our intervention districts, teachers were instructed not to fill it out. They're too busy, and so I don't know how to do that without making it mandatory. And I think Representative Seaton's concern was we need to somehow affect a contract with teachers to make that happen. But we surely want to do that. But short of making phone calls, I guess we could make phone calls to districts, and it could be a combination with support from SEAC, which is the organization that supports student achievement. But neither pro nor con, but just something to recognize that we have tried that, and without more force behind it, we don't have much, many results.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Seaton.
On that point, so, Commissioner, then, is there any problem with the state saying that in future contracts, all districts will have a requirement that teachers will do an exit survey that's designed by the state?
I would have to think that through and talk to legal, but I don't see a problem with that. And to be honest with you, if we really wanted to look at good data, I think we not only need exit surveys, but for teachers who are staying, what is empowering them to stay? I think that's the other side of that coin that's powerful. So would the parameters be small districts? Would the parameters be all districts? It could be a pretty large task. Could districts be encouraged to do it? That would be something for consideration.
Yeah. Representative Seaton.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you know, I think that, I mean, I don't want to get into a situation where we're interviewing every teacher every year, because teachers are either staying or they're leaving. So, you know, that's a huge task. But I think that we've been looking at the questions of why teachers leave, and if we don't have an answer to that, we're not going to be there. So, you know, I think that in here we actually need to put in that on the next renewal of contracts we require that school districts have a provision that will be in all contracts that on exit from the district they will fill out the survey created by the Department of Education. And so I'd like to put that in as a conceptual amendment.
Representative Wilson.
It's very difficult for a teacher to be honest when they exit. And here's the reason why. If it's because they had a rotten principal, am I going to say that? Because then they're not going to get a good recommendation to the next school. So it's sometimes when there's not good relationships within the school, sometimes if they want to get another job in another school system, it's very difficult to say, I think this place really needs some work, you know. And so,
And Mr. Chairman,
Representative,
that's why I'm saying that this would be a survey by the Department of Education, not by the district,
yeah.
Because it has to be segregated from the principal and the superintendent that there's a disagreement with. So,
Representative Kawasaki.
Yeah, I was just going to agree with Representative Seaton that the reason why the department would be the best person to engage in that is that there's 1 degree of separation between the previous employer,
yeah,
as it were, and so you would get more honest answers. And it's just like the private sector where you got a job, you don't put it on a resume if you really had a bad experience there, assuming, you know, that your boss didn't like you. Probably wouldn't put it on your resume, right? So I think it's sort of the same thing here, except I think you get more honest answers if it's somebody else that's mm-hmm. actually the engaging entity.
Representative Pruitt?
Yeah, I was just going to, kind of in the same vein that Representative Kawasaki was going, is I think if you've had a bad experience with the principal that's over you, you're probably not going to get a letter of recommendation from them anyways. And it's just like any business setting. If I'm leaving and I didn't have a good relationship, I'm probably going to state it, to tell you the truth, because I know I'm not going to get a recommendation from them. So I'm probably going to put down, hey, this was bad, you guys need to fix it. And it just gives an opportunity, I think, for those teachers to express the concerns that we really need to know about. So anyways, I actually support the idea of having them do that on exit, Representative Seaton.
Commissioner Dick, if I may, one suggestion would be, we have done phone calls, we have done surveys, and people have been relatively responsive when we can find them. If districts, if it was in this bill, if districts were, you know, that were in these restorative process, if they were required just to simply report to the department the teachers who have left, then we would not have to go try to track that information down. The department, within our abilities now, could make follow-up phone calls.
Yeah.
And it would be a relatively simple, doesn't mean we'd get them all, but if we knew at the end of a year who left, it's easier to track down than trying to search out who left and where they are. So that's something as simple as that could make a difference. Mm-hmm. And we could do that in-house.
How could committee, Representative Wilson?
And if they would add, you know, like their last known phone number or their cell phone or something so that you wouldn't have to go searching for it, you know.
Teacher certificate. I'm sorry, Rob.
Okay.
We do have most of those records.
Okay.
So, how can we wordsmith this in a short period of time? Representative Seaton.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and we need to figure out if we only want to have that information for school districts that are on restoration.
Right.
I mean, or is this something that we really needed?
We need it.
Across the state to find out why teachers are leaving. So personally, I would rather have it that we just put in there that future contracts have to include a provision that the teachers agree to do the survey with the Department of Education on exit. And that way we are not limiting our view. And then we find that, oh, well, we could have prevented a problem. We could have prevented people going into restoration because we would have caught the problem a lot earlier of what's happening in districts instead of waiting for districts to get into necessity of restoration.
Representative, I agree with you totally, but I'm thinking I'd like this bill to pass and get to the other side of the building, and if it would enhance that, I'd certainly how Representative Pruitt?
Maybe that's a potential for the Education Committee to put forth. Of course, we have to go through rules this year. Because I actually completely agree with the idea of having everyone, not just the intervention districts, filling this out. I think we need to understand what's going on out there. And we want our district, Department of Education to be as connected as possible. And if there's not a way to put it in here, I would like to consider maybe a discussion about doing it kind of as a whole there.
Is it a committee bill?
Yeah, potentially. Of course, it'd have to go through rules at this point. But
And Mr. Chairman, I don't think that we have any problems because what we're doing is defining the report to the legislature that they do. And so we're just adding this to the reasons for exit, so it doesn't reason for turnover, as it says. So I think that we can just put in, and I think conceptually we can do it right now and just say that we're going to require that future contracts by all districts will include a provision that the teachers will fill out the exit interview by the Department of Education, and we don't have to be more specific than that.
Okay. Representative Wilson?
On page 2, where we're looking at number 8 there says a number and percentage of and reasons for turnover in certified personnel and superintendents, and 9 says the number of teachers by district and by school. They're talking about all the schools, aren't they?
Yeah.
Every school? So that's already, we're already talking about all the schools.
Representative Wilson, number 9 talks about the teachers, the teaching outside their area of endorsement. That's really a whole new thought.
Yeah, but we're talking about all the schools under this section, aren't we?
Mm-hmm. Representative Seaton.
Yeah, section 1 relates to the report that's given by the department, and it covers all the schools. So it's not something that would be, if we're adding the reasons for exit and they have to report to us, we're not giving them a mechanism to do that.
I see.
Unless we say that the future contracts, the district shall require that teachers do this. I mean, you know, it's not going to be a felon if they don't, but at least it's in statute that they're required to do it, and it's in their contract that they do it, and they'll, we'll get a lot better, a lot better compliance.
Representative Seaton, you want, do you want to make a conceptual amendment?
I do. I thought I did. I will do it again. I'd like to move a conceptual amendment to section page 3, line, after line.
Page 2.
Page 2. Oh, yeah, page 2, at the end of line 15, that future district contracts will be required to include a provision that teachers and superintendents, or certified personnel and superintendents, will complete a exit survey as designed by the Department of Education.
Okay, and we have conceptual amendment number 5 before us. Is there any objection?
Just have a question.
Representative Kawasaki.
I just have a question, because in our district, we already do exit surveys, and so I'm just wondering if it's duplicative, or if there's some way to make sure that it's streamlined so that the department doesn't have to do work that's already being done by the, our school districts. Anchorage does an exit survey, too.
Representative Pruitt?
No, if you don't mind if I can dialogue, do they use an outside vendor for it?
No. It's internal.
One of the things I think is positive about using the district is then it will separate them from the principal. It will separate them from the people within their own district. Mm-hmm. And it will. I think we will probably get more honest answers if the district is actually producing and then gathering the information.
Excuse me, Representative Pruitt, you're saying if the district gathers or if the department gathers?
Sorry, if the department gathers, I think there will be a more honest conversation.
Okay. The district, that's right.
Yeah, okay. Okay, no, that's we right. Thank you for the correction. Okay.
Representative Kawasaki.
Just, and I agree, and I fully advocate for the change. I just want to make sure that folks know that this is a mandate for districts to do, or a mandate for the department to do on districts and for teacher contracts. So.
Okay. Any other objection? No objection. Amendment number 5 passes. Okay. Representative Seaton, you pointed out an omission on our part as to saying how all this is going to be funded.
That's correct, and hopefully the commissioner will be able to address that as well.
Are we speaking to this particular?
Why don't you, excuse me. Yeah. Commissioner Hanley, why don't you go ahead with your thoughts?
Okay. There are several things here, and I should pick and choose on ones that I think are most significant, and rather than walking through, and I can do that. On page 4. On line 20, 19 and 20, prescribed by regulation a minimum course of study for the public schools that includes elective and career and vocational courses in addition to the core curricula. I do believe that that changes our graduation requirements, because the regulation for a minimum course of study determines what students have to have to graduate. We have 21 credits for graduation, and I don't know if that was the intent, but this would change our graduation requirements from 21 to, I'm not sure, but at least 22 or 23 units. And I don't know that was the intent.
Commissioner Hanley, in my understanding, I didn't write this. This is part of the Moore case that we were trying to, blend the, we worked with a lawyer from the Moore case, Charles Wolford. And that's how this got folded in here. I wouldn't have included this at all.
I appreciate the focus on CTE, but when it says in addition to the minimum course of study, those are our minimum, those are our graduation requirements. And that's probably a separate topic that I'm guessing wasn't intended.
Okay. Yeah. Could you recommend what should we do here, sir?
In a previous version, I had seen that part of the focus and the advisement and the focus of the department would be to ensure that CTE courses were being offered. I would struggle in this conversation to focus to change your graduation requirements.
I would too.
So I think I'd have to leave it up to you, Chair Dick, or to the committee to determine if the focus is on CTE, that somehow that in the midst of these evaluations and these advisors, that be included in their focus, that cultural standards are incorporated, so is a focus on CTE.
Representative Wilson?
If we just took that includes on line 20, the first two words and just say ensuring elective and career and vocational courses in addition to core curricula. Because the problem is that some schools just zip right on into the onto the college course when there's a lot of kids that need to have some of those other courses. And since we're kind of already doing that with the school performance
scholarship,
whatever we'll call it, and I still want to call it the governor's. But anyway, I think if we just ensure that that process is happening, what does the committee members think about that?
They're public schools. Commissioner, how can we word this so that it would, we don't want to change graduation requirements and still make sure that the career and voc ed
are in there? Chair Dick, I guess just off the top of my head, I would be hesitant to be have it attached here to the minimum course of study. And unless the intent is to ensure that every child takes a CTE course. But, there are some students that want to take those AP courses and move right into college, and I don't know that every child should have to take a CTE course, but that opportunity should be available. So,
Representative Pruitt?
between that and includes, could? I mean, it kind of leaves it loose, but at least we're not then changing.
Representative Wilson?
This isn't saying that every child has to do this. This just says that it's available to ensure that it's there so that they can pick which way they want to go.
HB 330 deals with that, but we'll deal with it now. Representative, was it Seaton? Did you have a comment, sir?
Yes, I guess I am confused because this is the department shall, and then we're on. I guess I'm at the same point. If this is the first part of number four is prescribed by regulations, the minimum course of study, and American Sign Language, I mean, that is the graduation requirements. Done. So I think that if we're going to have this, that schools will be required to provide career and vocational technical courses in addition to core curricula, that should be separated as a separate requirement and not put it into the prescribed minimum section.
Okay. I'm having a thought here. Commissioner, maybe the best path here would be for you and I to sit down. You give me your thoughts. We'll come up with I really wanted to get this out of committee today, but I bet this could go on for a bit here. So why don't you and I sit down. We'll just work out everything you have I'd like to incorporate. But in the meantime, Representative Pruitt.
Mr. Chair, I'd actually feel comfortable if we, because we're dealing with the minimum, and not saying that you can't address it later, but maybe we do just strike that language right there, that we go ahead and take out that includes elective and career and vocational courses in addition to core curricula. I don't know that I'd be comfortable moving out a bill where we're trying to address one issue and potentially creating a whole different issue. I don't want to see that collateral damage.
And I think that these are policy decisions that we're making here, and so I think that we all need to be involved in it rather than, you know, because there may be some things just because the commissioner doesn't want them that we want. Mm-hmm. And so we may have to, you just said that you would work it out that everything he wanted he got, and we may not want to do that.
Well, I don't know that he said that.
That's probably correct.
My intent was maybe the commission, because I have no idea how much more he has.
Yeah.
And I did want to at least get going, get the thoughts on 313. So I bet this is going to take more time than we have here today. So if the committee doesn't mind, I'd like to set this aside. Are we in the middle of something? Let's set this aside and for now, and I'll work with the commissioner, and we'll come back next Monday, and I bet we'll have lots of quick answers.
Okay.
Is that everybody satisfied with that? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am satisfied with that. The question was also on public testimony on this drastically revised bill, and the superintendents, at least you have a chance to address
this. Then we'll notify everybody that they have a chance to speak to it. Commissioner, thank you. Appreciate you being flexible.
Chair Dick, I do appreciate that opportunity. I think there are a lot of things that would just clarify in probably a simpler form, and if I would have the opportunity to speak again, because I would agree that there are probably some areas that I think you and I would not agree on that I should like to share as well. But I think we could probably clean up a lot of
that. We want something that works. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Feige. Where's my script here? Okay, next we'll hear HB 313, Student Count Estimates. Representative Poole, will you move Committee CS Version M for adoption, 313?
M or X?
My understanding is M.
Oh.
All right. Mr. Chair, I move Committee Substitute for HB 313 Version M, dated 3-1, for adoption as a working document.
Okay.
Objection.
Thank you. Okay, we have Committee Substitute House Bill 313 Version M before us. Representative Feige, please make comments before your staff walks us through the changes.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Representative Eric Feige, District 12. You guys should all have a sectional analysis on the CS in front of you. There are two sections that have been changed here. Everything else essentially was the same as version A. Section 4, it adds a provision to the bill prohibiting a municipal assembly from taking funds away from a school district after having allocated the funds to the district. What that, in talking with some of the CFOs that run these districts, one of their frustrations is that they may do very well on managing their money, and typically most of these districts actually spend less than what their budgets, what they have planned in their budgets. But for some that lie within municipalities or boroughs, the borough local government currently has the option at the end of the year, if there is a surplus remaining in that district's unrestricted funds account, they have the ability to go in and reallocate or reappropriate that money. And this is the local contribution money. They can reappropriate it for something else. Now, this is something of a shell game with the public, because at the start of the year and when the budget originally comes out, local government announces that they're spending X amount on education, and then at the end of the year they quietly pull money that they had allocated for it back out of the system. So it would be a great help to those districts if that it was the ability to reappropriate that money was curtailed. Section 7, under current statute, the unrestricted reserve account is limited to 10%. The school district can maintain only up to 10% of what they have expended in the current school year. They can only retain 10% to the next succeeding school year. This would change that and raise it to 15%, which would, in combination with the ability, with taking away the ability to reallocate monies by the local government and allowing the districts to maintain a greater reserve, gives them better capabilities to manage fluctuations in their cash flow and actually manage their money instead of having it managed for them. So at this point, are there any? And then finally, Section 11 is the effective date clause, which I believe we added here. The fiscal note has not changed, so are there any other questions on the CS?
Again. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This last year, due to a whole bunch of combinations of things, of money not getting spent in the Kenai Peninsula, just by a timing difference, and maybe your 10 to 15% would have covered that this year, the school district had to return some money to the borough because they were over their legally allowed cap. How does this provision of not being allowed to have the borough take the money, what's that going to influence as far as a district that would be in that situation? Are they then breaking the law one way or the other, or does the Department of Education take the excess funds by reducing the contribution to the district the same way they do if you contribute over the cap? Then state funding is reduced by that amount.
First of all, it allows the Kenai Borough sits right close to the 10% cap, so it would raise that cap, give them more latitude to be able to run up to that cap if necessary. As far as whether the ability to reallocate or reappropriate that money, I suppose you're correct. It's if they were at the cap, and the local government would still not be able to take the money out.
So,
Representative Seaton.
So, in that kind of a circumstance, like the Kenai Peninsula, then the state would just take the money because they would reduce state funding for the school district on any amount that was over. Is that what that would happen?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, it's Michael Pascal, staff to Representative Feige. And I'm not sure if Elizabeth Newelman with the department has returned back in, because I know she needed to be in another hearing. She can correct me if I'm incorrect, or she wants to come up and address that. Do you want to address that question?
Yes.
Okay, let's have her address that question.
For the record, I'm Elizabeth Noodleman, Director of School Finance for the Department of Education. And through the chair, Representative Seaton, in the law, if a school district has more than 10% in unreserved fund balance at the end of the year, then the state would reduce state funding. So you are correct, that money would be returned to the state.
Follow up. So under the current circumstance, the borough had funded additional money above the minimum, the 4 mil or whatever that calculation is, and so the school district was able to return that money to stay within the cap to the borough. And if we pass this way, then the only option would be for that, the district would have had to pay the money, or would have paid the money, but the money would then come to the state, would reduce the state funding for the school. So it would, they couldn't transfer it to the borough, they'd have to transfer it to the state. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, if they were returning the money because they were at the cap and they were choosing to return it to their local government rather than the state, that is correct.
Representative Feige, if I understand correctly, I heard last year too that there was times in Section 4 where we shovel money into one end of the district and the money was taken out the back end. And if I understand correctly, this would fix that problem. And in Section 7, it seems to me that what we're doing is we're providing the districts with the security of knowing what their budget is going to be in the down the road, but the idea being that they need more flexibility because the student count could go up or down more, and they need that greater leeway in order to be able to respond to the changes that aren't foreseen. So if I understand correctly, these are both really good changes. I'm trying to imagine what objection there might be, and I can't. So maybe testimony will speak to that, but I believe these changes are good.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Feig, again, I think what the problem that Representative Seaton is raising can be fixed by a conceptual amendment, and perhaps we can deal with that in a second. Are there any other questions regarding the CS?
Okay. Michael, were you going to?
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, excuse me. Representative Seaton.
On Section 8, is this a change to the version?
No, sir. It was a.
That's the same as
it was. Section 8 is the same as Section 6 and Version A.
Okay.
Thank you. There's no change.
Michael, if you want to walk us through, please. Excuse me, was there an objection?
There was.
I believe I might have objected, so I'll remove my objection to the adoption of version M.
Okay. Very good. Okay, version M is adopted. Michael, do you want to walk us through, please?
Mr. Chair, addressing the changes that Representative Feige addressed are the only changes from the original version of the bill, so unless, I guess, there are particular questions, we do have two amendments that I believe Representative Feige will offer.
Representative Feige.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have two conceptual amendments, and the first one is the short one. Would be a change in Section 6, and currently we have a provision where if the population of the district increases by a certain percentage, in this case 5%, then it would be eligible for supplemental funding in the current year from the Department of Education.
Which
page?
What page? What line?
Mr. Chair, page 8, line 20. I'm sorry.
Okay, page 8, line 20. Representative Feige.
Okay. We have a threshold of 5% currently in the bill. Obviously, depending on the total number of folks and what the count is on your adjusted daily or average daily membership, 5% can be a lot of money or it can be a little bit of money. There was a fair amount of resistance from some of the larger districts. They objected basically because it was just so much money at 5%. So we're in the conceptual amendment, we're simply lowering that to a 3% threshold. Keep in mind, most student populations don't change by typically more than about 1% or less.
Comment from committee?
Well,
are you going to move?
I'm moving conceptual amendment number one.
Okay.
Object
for the sake of discussion. Go ahead.
I am from a large school district, so I'm going to have to object at this point.
No, that's 4-4. It's better.
It is better, but it's still 1,200 students. And my school district's 1,200 students is a lot of money, and we don't jump that much. We will jump between, from my time on the School Budget Advisory Commission, I would see anywhere from 200 to 900 students. So we would still potentially be in a place where we could have several hundred students and not have the funding. it is better, but I can't, I couldn't continue to support it this way. So, one, maybe if you don't mind me kind of just speaking out loud here, being that between 200 and 300 is probably, it's a little less than 1% for my district, but that still may be something within their manageable, their ability to manage. It's still a lot. We put something that said increases by the lesser of 200 students or 3%.
I would agree to that. That's fine.
Okay. So I would move a conceptual amendment to conceptual amendment number one to conceptual amendment number one. I think we have it there. That would say that would have increases by the on line 20, so 8 line 20, the lesser of 200 students or 3%. And it will allow the drafters to correct in the specific grammatical, et cetera.
Do you want to object for discussion?
Object for discussion. Only because you just said it was between 200 and 900.
Exactly. That's why I'm saying...
What percent is 200 of your population?
That's about 0.5. It's about half a percent. It's actually... We have about 44,000 kids. So 440 would be about 1%. About 220 would be about half a percent. And that's and of course, while it half a percent doesn't sound like much, it is still 200 some kids at the current, current student-based allocation. That's just, what are we at? We're at 5,800 now. Yeah. So, that would be, let's just say it's 200 students. I mean, that you're talking about, at this point, $1.1 million for my district.
But what percent is that of your budget?
Oh, it's a pretty large budget, but a million...
What percent is that of your budget?
Good question, because we're about $700 million or so.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying, because a little school system that has a tiny budget, you understand? I'm just saying, comparatively, that would be that much to them.
Excuse me, Representative Feige.
Mr. Pascoe can address how much money the Anchorage School District has in reserve and how much money is in that account.
Mike Pascoe. Okay.
Through the chair. The Anchorage School District, and this is a question that we've debated through all of this and developing this. The Anchorage School District has in their unreserved fund balance approximately $56 million. And so as we developed the bill, we looked at those four districts, and with the larger districts, with the exceptions of the ones where the municipalities take all the money back out, they all have the money to cover the funding for the year. But I think the amendment to the amendment here actually increases a comfort level there that certainly as the person who's worked on this bill, I don't see as being a problem. When you start looking at the smaller districts, the issue, you start looking at percentages versus dollars and what is the impact, and sometimes percentages are an issue, sometimes the actual dollars are the issues. But the Second Amendment that we have to present addresses that issue, because what we're looking at is a carryover from this year to next year and being able to make it to the next year, because how much money do we have to make? Because the next year you get the money. So, and the Second Amendment addresses that specific question, which was designed more oriented toward the smaller districts. So I think that'll satisfy what concern you have.
Is the whoever made the objection to the amendment number one to amendment number one, is that objection still stand?
Apparently not.
Representative Wilson, let's get it straight. Go ahead.
Yeah. I just want to make it fair, so maybe if amendment number two was offered first, then I would, I mean, I don't know. I really don't know, but I'm saying what it looks like then is that, so they're going to get it next year anyway, so they are going to get that the next year. So this isn't really that big of a deal. So,
Representative Wilson, through the chair, it's a cash flow issue. It's not an income issue.
Oh.
Okay, because if you start back to the basis of the bill, the only thing we're doing is changing the timing of the funding, not the amount of the funding. But where some of the objections that were raised from the districts was cash flow. Even though when I look at the numbers for the majority of the districts, it's not a cash flow issue. I did not speak to Anchorage, although we've been available for them. They have, but Representative Pruitt, I understand, has. Fairbanks raised a similar objection. When I look at their available funds, they have the cash flow to do this. But if that's a concern to them, we tried to come up with a solution. So the amendment with the amendment to the amendment addresses that concern, and I believe we're comfortable with that as the presenter of the bill. But your concern is the other one that was raised is we literally don't have the money, and the second amendment that we have here allows for an alternative funding method in the current year.
Okay.
Even if what we've just done doesn't work, we have an alternative put out there.
All right. Okay. I'll remove my objection.
Okay. Hearing no further objection,
then I will remove my objection to conceptual amendment number one.
Then amendment number one passes.
As amended.
As amended. Okay. Representative Feige.
At this time, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move conceptual amendment number two. Another piece of paper to add a new section, and that new section would read, if a district is unable to meet current year funding needs and is not protected by the provisions of AS 14-17-410-B1H, the district may apply to the department for supplemental funding for the current fiscal year. And so I moved it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. For discussion.
Yeah. Okay. Make the motion.
Okay. I did make
motion made, and you object for discussion. And the discussion is what page are we on?
Page 8, line 29 would be where this is inserted, and the reference statute is the one we were just looking at on the same page.
Page 8, what line what?
This would go at line 29, after following line 29. There's a new subsection there.
Okay. Representative, you want to speak to the amendment?
What we're trying to address here is especially in a small district where the addition of one or two, three kids doesn't necessarily cross even the 3% threshold, but because they would be either some kind of special needs or intensive needs kids, the cost would be significant and the cost itself would exceed the threshold. Basically, it's also to meet any other kind of requirements for additional funding that we just can't foresee at this point. So it's kind of the catch-all, if you will, and allows districts, if they find themselves with no reserves and no additional expenses, that they can still seek funding from the department.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. So needing additional funding because of this chapter or this section that we're adding, or is this just for any reason they can apply to the department if they don't have enough money to operate?
The intent would be if they find themselves in a position where they do not have reserves for whatever circumstances that have driven that, if they are without reserves, and they have additional expenses that they've incurred because of changes in their school population, this gives them an avenue to seek supplemental funding from the department. It's not intended to be used every year. It's basically only for special cases.
And I can agree with that, the changing of the timing of the formula. But as I read this, it just says, hey, if you don't have reserves for any reason, you didn't budget right, you hired two more teachers because you wanted more teachers, you can apply and the department will give you supplemental funding for the current fiscal year. So I think it needs to be tightened to the change in the student count timing.
Okay, Ms.
Representative Feige.
Representative Seaton through the chair. It says the district may apply. It doesn't say the department has to give them the money. So if they've been irresponsible, then they've been irresponsible. But there still has there are going to be unforeseen circumstances that we need to leave at least some kind of provision in this bill so we don't end up with a bankrupt school district in the middle of a school year.
And I totally agree if that's driven by the change in the student count. Otherwise, I mean, we're getting into a fundamental change if we're saying that districts can apply if they don't have enough money to the department for supplemental funding, and we put that in statute, and then the department is left with, okay, oh, school district A, we're going to bankrupt, but now we have the ability to take money from someplace and give it to this other school district, having nothing related to the student count. I just want to make sure, I totally agree with you, as long as we tie this to the forward, or the by the student count from the preceding year and a problem. I mean, the purpose of your bill is to go back and do the preceding year. I don't think the purpose of the bill is to say that for any reason school districts can come to the department and now apply for supplemental funding.
Representative Wilson?
I propose an amendment to the amendment that would say at the end of that first line, if a district is unable to meet current year funding, cross out needs and add because of change in student counts and is not protected, then the rest of it the way it is.
I believe that's what's in paragraph H. Okay, it's not protected by the provisions of paragraph H. In other words, your student count has not exceeded beyond the threshold. This is the opportunity to do that.
Okay. I remove that then, because I think you're right. That does cover that. And it does, because we are talking about the student counts. So. Okay.
The intent is not is not to simply reward bad behavior.
Yeah.
But if a district, especially a small district, finds itself in a position because of, you know, the couple of students that they did get all happen to be special needs, and now the district needs to hire a teacher at, you know, out in the bush somewhere, it could be $70,000-$80,000 for that salary plus benefits makes it 100. That's going to blow their budget. And it's beyond their control. They can't do anything about it. They can apply to the department. The department may or may not, depending on the circumstances, award them the funding.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I thought this was adding a new section, not a subsection of H. So if we're not changing with a subsection of H, then we are on page 7, line 5. This is the adjusted ADM will be calculated as following. So if
brief it is, the meeting.
So,
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a conceptual amendment. So is this a subsection of H, or is this a new section I?
I believe it'd be a new section I.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, if it's a new section I, then it is not relating to H. It is relating to page 7, line 5, which is the district adjusted ADM is calculated by this factor. Just because you relate and say, well, if you're not protected by that one, you're still saying that if a district's unable to meet its current needs, then it's changing the district adjusted ADM and it's putting in a whole new provision. If you're unable to meet your current funding needs, then you apply to the department for supplemental funding. So it's if it's a subsection of H, so that it only applies to um, the 3% or the 5%, the from the preceding, the count change, then it works. But if it's a section I, it's a total change to the adjusted ADM calculation, which says that we are now saying that districts can apply to the department. Okay. Maybe they have that ability now, but it sure doesn't say so in the adjusted
Michael.
ADM.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, I understand the protection that you're trying to, in writing this for Representative Feige's conceptual amendment, the intent was to do what it is that you're suggesting, and that is that only in the situation, and that's why I wrote the protected by the provisions of Section H. In other words, if they're not protected because of the count change of greater than 3%, then they could actually ask the department, and it was modeled strictly after, for example, there's a district that has a $26,000 reserve, and that is 5% of their operating budget, if I'm looking correctly. So the most they can have in reserve isn't enough to cover hiring a single intensive need aide. So they would have to have some type of assistance in order to exist in that unique situation. So that's what it was designed for, and I agree it should be worded in the actual language to make sure that it only applies to districts that had a school count change and no other purpose. Absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And if we, you know, if we can get it drafted that way, that's mm-hmm. fine with me. But if it's going to be as a new section I, then I don't believe it does that, and we're going way beyond the purposes of the bill.
Okay. I understand. What I don't understand is where brief it is. Back to order. So, Representative Feige, do you want to make additional changes, or do you want to withdraw the amendment for now and move on to your...
We'll draw the amendment.
Okay.
And add a conceptual amendment number 3.
Mm-hmm.
Conceptual amendment number 3 refers to page 5, line 9. This addresses Representative Seaton's issue from earlier. I would re-script that to say in line 8 and 9, the Assembly may not reallocate or reappropriate for another purpose the amount appropriated from local sources to the district for school purposes unless the unrestricted reserve account is at the maximum amount. In this case, we've amended it to, let me find the section that covers that here.
The 15%?
Yeah, the 15%. And that would be, okay, so amount appropriated from local sources to the district for school purposes unless the unrestricted portion of its year-end fund balance in the school operating fund exceeds the amount set in Section 7, AS 14-17-505A.
Okay with that? You want to object?
In plain English, what is that? I object for discussion.
If the school district is at its maximum reserve amount, then they can reallocate.
What if they don't even have a reserve account? A lot of school districts
don't. Then the assembly cannot go and pull money back out.
Of
the school district's budget.
Representative Wilson.
I guess I'm just lost.
Part of what's,
Representative Feige.
What's been happening in certain districts, not all, is at the end of the year, the school district has operated well. They've managed their finances and their business appropriately, and they end up with a surplus. The local government, the borough assembly in this case, reaches back into the school district's finances and pulls money out, reallocates it on a sidewalk.
Oh, okay.
Okay? This would prevent them from essentially playing that shell game with the money. Because remember, at the start of the year, when they came out with their budget, we're spending $27 million on education. We're great. But then they're really reappropriating a bunch of that money out instead of leaving it in.
So this is chucked altogether?
Representative Wilson?
That's we've withdrawn number two.
Okay. I thought you were trying to redo number two.
I was redressing Representative Seaton's question from when I was up
there. Okay. Okay. Gotcha. Okay, I removed my objection.
And with no further objection, the amendment passes.
But we're just going to dump this one?
Mr. Chairman.
Excuse me, Representative Wilson, I think Representative Feige is going to rewrite number two. Is that correct, sir?
Mr. Chairman, if the committee will allow me, I just assume I can rewrite that and present it to finance as an amendment. I believe we can accomplish that, but just soon pass the bill out.
Brief at ease.
On the record, committee back to order.
Again, for the record, Elizabeth Noodleman, Director of School Finance, and Chair Dick, I'm happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
I guess I have a question. With what you've heard and seen here, do you see is there anything unforeseen that we haven't seen that you could help us address here, that any unforeseen consequences?
Chair Dick, in regards to the conceptual amendment, when I read that, I was also concerned that it was not in the proper place to keep districts from simply asking for funds, and so I would agree with the discussion that the committee is having on that on that count. And then I would just add that there is a fiscal note with this bill that when districts receive funding, in addition, because their count has gone up, that is in addition. It's not just a cash flow. It is in addition to what their funding would have been under the old system. And moving to 3%, we would look at that fiscal note again.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
That's a big
comments from committee. Question from committee. Representative Seaton.
And so the $1 million at 5%, do you have any estimate of what that would be, or is that a calculation that has to be made at 3%?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that was an estimate, and I really would want to go back and look at that again, especially based on, you know, some of the amendments and get a good number for you.
Okay. Representative Wilson?
I just agree with her. I think that's a big deal. That we change that to 3%, that's a big deal.
Chairman.
Okay. Representative Feige.
If I may add.
Or does it change it to the lesser 200 students?
Representative Feige.
If I may ask her a question, Ms. Noodleman, what is the current amount of money that the state spends on education per year?
Through the chair, Representative Feige, this is a very rough number, but state entitlement in the public school funding program is around $1 billion.
$1 billion. And this fiscal note is about, at 5% is a million. If I have it, rough estimate, 2 million, even 3 million.
Again, through the chair, I wouldn't disagree with your estimate, but I would want to calculate it.
Okay, so we're talking about an addition of $2 million in excess of $1 billion funding stream.
Okay. Elizabeth?
Through the chair, I follow your logic, Representative Feige.
Yeah, this has 1/2,000 of what we currently spend.
Okay. Representative Seaton?
Thank you. Ms. Newland, if we put that under H as a subsection of H, so that the conceptual amendment number two, does that satisfy you that we're not putting in a new a new topic for the ADM calculation, but it would only relate to the adjusted student count of four forward counts.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, for the schools that would fall into the categories of the additional percentages, that would be satisfactory. I have not given any thought to the schools that may have a change in enrollment that do not fall into those 3 or 5% categories.
Okay. Representative Feige, my suggestion is that I'm as desperate as you are to get bills out of this committee, but my suggestion is we just bring it back on Monday and
let's do it now.
Excuse me? Go ahead, Representative Wilson.
I think we can do it now.
You think we can do it now?
Have we had public testimony on this bill?
Have we?
Have we had public testimony on the bill?
It was open for testimony. We've had, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. What's the wish of the committee?
In large regard, these amendments are in response to public testimony, mm-hmm. as well as private conversations with folks that actually do the work of managing the money.
Okay.
And if I've already withdrawn conceptual amendment number two, may I reintroduce a conceptual amendment number four?
Representative Feige. Okay.
Conceptual amendment number four, using the same text as conceptual amendment number two, with the addition that it be as a subsection of AS 1417410B1H.
Okay. Hearing no objection, that amendment passes. Okay. Representative Wilson.
I move the CS for House Bill 313, version M, as amended from committee with individual recommendation and accompanying fiscal note.
Hearing no objection, the CS will pass from committee. And with as amended with accompanying fiscal note. And next meeting will be Monday, March 5. We'll take up superintendent presentation from Nenana. Superintendent will be here. HB 272, student loan interest reductions. HB 330, state education standards. And HB 256, we'll finish that one off. Nothing meeting March 7 to 9. No further business. We're adjourned at 10:25.